Blog Talk Radio.
Informal Paranormal. I'm Michael Jones. I'm joined by my co-host John Rossi.
Hey Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing great tonight, guy. And we're also joined by Tim Campbell, who's our regional director with Paranexus, and also an investigator with Shenandoah Shadows.
And hello there.
And these guys did an investigation this weekend that was pretty interesting, actually, some of the stuff that they were noticing, although it really wasn't paranormal, but it was good examples of what not to do, I think. So how you guys doing tonight?
Oh, well, I'm a little tired. Had a long night last night, and then a long drive afterwards, and got just a few hours sleep today. Tim and I drove out on Saturday from Virginia. We drove out to Moundsville, West Virginia to do an investigation at the Moundsville Penitentiary. And this was a public event. And it turned out to be a little bit less than we expect. Well, actually, I think we got what we paid for. It didn't quite turn out as well as we were hoping, just in terms of our co-investigators for the night. Well, there were about 75 people total.
Right.
So, and it was a little bit rough.
Yeah. Well, before we go too far into this, could you and Tim actually give us a background on the penitentiary?
When you go there, you know, for one of these events, they give you a complete tour of the penitentiary. It's about an hour and a half long, and they take you throughout the entire facility, which is, you know, huge. And, you know, they give you a history of, you know, historical events, as well as like a paranormal history in terms of where things, you know, allegedly had occurred over time and stuff. Prison was built or became operational in the latter part of the 1860s. It initially housed Confederate prisoners. And the prison was in operation from the late 1860s all the way till 1995 when they closed it.
Okay.
And let me just tell you something. This is one rugged place. These guys that got put in there, this was not an easy ride for them by any means. Back into the 90s, they still didn't have air conditioning there. And in these huge blocks where the prisoners were put, they're like four stories tall. You know, it's one giant, like, you know, room with cages. And at the fourth level, like during the summertime and stuff, the temperature stayed at about 110 degrees.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then I guess they were kind of confused why this was one of the most violent prisons in the entire country. It's because it was one very, very rough place. The cells in there, do you remember what the dimensions were, Tim? 6x8?
Not even that, I don't think. Maybe 4 or 5x8? I don't know. It was very small. And then the maximum security section, they only had two bunks in a cell, but they had three prisoners in each cell at one point. And prisoner had to sleep on the floor.
Oh, my gosh.
So
it was like boxes.
Again, it is. And, like, you know, 4x6 or 5x8, we're not talking very much room. And these guys, you know, depending on what section, if they were in the maximum security wing of this prison, they were locked in this cage for up to 22 hours a day.
Mm.
With three men sharing a 5-foot by 8-foot space. So,
weren't you telling me that the actual sink and commode system was actually the same unit? I'm talking about how horrible things are. you know.
Yes, essentially, if you envision a one-piece toilet, and the top of your toilet tank would actually have an indentation in it where it creates like a sink. And so you'd brush your teeth and wash your face basically standing over the toilet bowl.
Wow.
So.
In other words, it was literally a gerbil cage for people.
Yeah.
You'd have to have a trap.
Yeah.
Wow.
It certainly was definitely the cage defect in there. The building itself, you know, the oldest section of the building, well, actually the entire building was built in a style that's reminiscent of like European castles, you know, the big giant cut stones and stuff like that. And everything was on like a massive scale, you know, like the doors in this facility, not the cell doors, but like, you know, doors and hallways and entryways, you know, they were like, you know, 20 feet tall and very imposing place.
Excuse me, guys. Yeah.
Yeah, it has a. People have been to the website or seen websites about it. You can see the like castellated walls and the turrets that are there, give it a very medieval look, be formidable looking.
Oh, so this was actually made out of bedrock stone, the walls and everything.
I'm not sure what exactly they used, but
it was large stones. It wasn't just like brick.
The walls were 5 feet. Thick at the ground level, and they tapered up to 2.5 feet at the top, and they went below the surface 5 feet down.
Wow.
So, pretty massive walls.
Yeah. So, was there any particular places that actually caught your interest as far as felt like there was something going on?
Yeah, let me just, there's a couple questions in the chat room. They're just, Catherine's asking, did they actually have a toilet bowl? Well, these toilet tank things aren't porcelain. It's all made out of stainless steel. It's a one-piece unit. And literally, you know, whoever was sleeping on the floor, you know, either their feet or their head was going to be up against the toilet. And Sharon's asking, you know, did they clean their own cells and stuff? And the answer to that is if they want to, because having worked, you know, I used to at one point work in the jail. And the inmates in the jail, you know, when they're locked up like that, especially the ones that are in maximum security, don't have a whole lot to lose in terms of, like, at this point, they have no privileges or anything. So they do things like throw cups of urine on the guards as they walk by, or throw feces out of the cell, or they'll smear the walls with feces trying to, you know, just, you know, create havoc. And typically it would stay that way until they chose to clean it. So it's a pretty rough environment.
Well, there was two different levels, though. It was the maximum security section where they had the worst, most violent type offenders, and unfortunately for people in that section, that was the most crowded section where they had three to a cell. And the other cells where they had, I guess, the less violent, I guess if you call it that, they were actually allowed to decorate their own cells and paint. And then many of the cells we saw their own homemade like artwork on their cell walls that they decorated their own cells.
Yeah, so, and actually, you know, some of the hallways had like murals painted or like faux paintings that the inmates had you know, were allowed to paint. And, excuse me, the quality of the artwork on some of them, well, was pretty amateurish, but other ones were quite good.
Yeah, there were a couple of different prisoners who contributed quite a lot to the murals throughout the building, like in the cafeteria, in various different places.
Yeah. So, did any of the artwork in any of the cells particularly catch your attention there, Tim?
Well, the one I remember we saw where it was like flowery, and the one was like a pink with
right.
Like some kind of black pattern over top of it. It's kind of abstract, but just kind of not what you would expect, you know, in a prison cell. But I guess if you spent so much time, you know, in a place like that, I guess you would try to make it as habitable as possible.
Yeah, I would say that some of the artwork in those cells, you know, those prisoners literally had spent hundreds and hundreds of hours, because we're talking just incredibly detailed, like, floral prints and things of that nature, and it was pretty amazing. There was a particular one, I think, that caught your mind when we were down in the section where it was the maximum security section. It was just a line drawing on the wall with the nuclear warning symbol incorporated.
Oh, right, it's a face and a skull with big fangs and spikes coming out of the skull.
Kind of
dramatic looking.
Yeah, well, that was a pretty twisted, nightmarish drawing, that's for sure.
Wow.
Mike had asked, were there any places that, you know, particularly resonated for you in terms of when we were, like, walking through the facility?
We made the whole tour of the whole facility, and you had the first experience outside the cafeteria where you said you heard somebody speak.
Yeah, we were walking past that doorway, and it was a man's voice. I mean, like, literally it felt like it was right next to my ear. I spoke, and actually I was surprised later, because when we went back there to investigate, to find that the door, for whatever reason, I thought we were going to be able to go into that room, and the door was locked. But
I wonder if that was a guard, you know, observation area for the cafeteria.
Yeah, that was a cafeteria. That would have been an observation area. So, and the voice that I heard was, like, very commanding. You know, it was like, you know, it wasn't an engaging kind of thing. I couldn't make out what was being said, but, you know, I would put on the level of someone, like, commanding someone or telling someone very, you know, forcefully to do something.
I think the next place that... Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying the next place that we both kind of, you know, got a feeling was up in the medical building, a medical section in the admin building, admin section, and in the psych ward area.
Right. You know,
just
I had a real
top of the stairs, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had a real physical reaction. We walked up the stairs, and we were on the top floor of the main prison building where the infirmary and the dental offices, basically all the medical related things, were located. But as I was getting approaching that floor level on the stairs, I got all lightheaded to the point that I thought I was going to have to sit down, because I was going to, like, fall over. My equilibrium was all whacked out, and it was just like, literally, it was like passing through something. And it wasn't like, you know, the sensation of, like, perhaps when you interact with the spirit. It was kind of different than that. And
like an environmental thing? Kind of, I mean, like a wall?
Yeah. It was like when I got to the top of the stairs and we went down that hallway, I'm feeling, like, a lot more tired than I should be from the little bit of stairs we did.
Right.
You know, right. I remember we caught up with each other. We kind of congregated near each other, and I turned to you and said, you know, are you feeling anything? And obviously you were feeling what you were feeling. So we both had that feeling there.
Hmm. Yeah, that was actually probably one of the most physically intense feelings that I've had on an investigation to date. And, you know, I'm not sure how to explain exactly what it was like, other than it really felt like almost like we went through a membrane or an energy field or something, and you know, all of a sudden we're on one side of it, and the next we're on the other, and it's like, you know, literally, I really thought that there was a good chance that I was going to have to go down to the ground because of how much it affected me.
Well, you know, that's like that experience I had up at the sanatorium I was telling you about, John. I was walking down this hallway, and literally you could put your hand out, and there was like a wall of energy. And when you walk through it, it kind of disoriented you, but as you walk through it, it kind of got weaker on the other side till it dissipated. And it was just like, I could see, if you're trying to climb stairs, how that would actually make you dizzy.
Yeah, I just don't, you know, like Sharon's commenting about, she had a similar thing happen to her at Jordan Springs when she was going up the stairs and approaching the third floor, which is, you know, basically the most
many people have had that feeling. Many people felt that at the top of the stairs in that billiard room section.
So, you know, you got to wonder whether or not, you know, we're talking about some kind of residual energy that's now just in place there and we're perceiving it at some level. Because at that point, I didn't feel any, like, intelligence. I didn't feel like something was interacting with me. I didn't feel like I was under some kind of psychic attack. Nothing like that. It literally felt like it was something environmental over something, you know, with intelligence and, you know, like an entity or something.
You know, it almost makes you wonder if it's not like that membrane between physical and spiritual that you're actually perceiving, and that's where the crossover is when they're actually mixing, you know, as far as being able to interact.
You know, like I said, you know, I don't know what to say about, you know, there's another question Catherine's asking about is the air quality poor in there. Most of the places, this is not like climate controlled, and I don't know. There was plenty of airflow, unfortunately, because it was about, at that point, what, about 30 degrees outside, Tim?
Something like that, yeah.
There was cool air circulating pretty much through most of the building.
Wasn't heat an issue. Yeah, heat wasn't an issue.
Yeah. Now, you know, there were parts of the building, though, that were, like, you know, down in the basement or the boiler room where the air was real stale and kind of funky. And, you know, I could see how that could potentially affect people's perception. Not that, you know, there's any kind of, like, you know, pollutant or something that's affecting you, but just overall, you know, contributing to that sense of foreboding and something's not being right, just because of the smells and like the claustrophobicness of those locations.
Some of the entryways are narrow. Yeah, they're really narrow, some of the entranceways, and there's cages, and it's just, you know, it just kind of gives you a rat in a maze feel as you're going down in there.
Yep. When, as we walked down this medical floor, we went from basically where the somatic health issues are to the mental health issues. So we ended up on their psych unit. And their psychiatric care was pretty basic. Basically what they did was, if you were a normal psych patient, they tied you in four-point restraints into your bed, which means literally they tied your foot on one side of the bed, each of your feet on each side of the bed, and your hands on each side of the bed so you couldn't get up or hit or kick or anything like that. And that's basically how they treated you there. Now, there were people in there that were so violent and so out of control that that wasn't sufficient in terms of being able to control them. And they had these, like, little solitary cells that were, I don't know, 4x6 maybe. They were real tiny. And, you know, they had no windows or anything, and they would lock these patients in these rooms. And that's another location where there was a sense of an entity and intelligence. And for me, it was a pretty in-your-face kind of location. What was your thoughts on it, Tim?
There was a little, like, a screen window on each cell, but it was high up to where anybody in there wouldn't have been able to look out, really, I don't think.
Right.
But I think what happened there was that while they were serving pizza, you and I kind of snuck off and went there as quick as we could, you know, to avoid the rush and the crowds.
Yeah, but What was your thoughts?
And about that time is when the first of the people started coming up the back stairwell. And I think I ended up with I think it's probably very potential for some residual. I didn't feel anything, you know, definite, but I think it would be definitely a place to investigate more. You know. feel, you know, that there was a presence in there when I was in there. But I did do some EVP, so we'll see.
Okay, Mike, I want your unbiased opinion here, and anyone in the chat room would like to chime in, I'd like to hear it too. Now, generally, my concept is that, you know, investigative teammates, and they look out for each other. Is that correct, Mike? Do you agree
with that?
That's right.
That's the reason it's so important to go in pairs, right?
Yeah. So imagine this. You know, you're out there with someone you think's watching your back, and you're walking out in the exercise yard where there's been mass riots and numerous murders, and actually, you know, in an area where, you know, the old death house was, where they had executed some, I think, 87 people, all said and done. So you're out there, and, you know, you're trying to make contact with, you know, some rather unsavory spirits, and your teammate, who's supposed to be watching your back, announces to everyone that, hey, he used to work in a prison. What do you think about this? What do you think about that? Is that like being thrown under the bus or what?
Well, John, if you remember correctly, before you went on this investigation, and I did, if you remember correctly, I told you that the best way to get these spirits to interact with you is to wear a police outfit.
Well, I had some better alternatives in terms of getting them to interact, but Tim was kind of being closed-minded, and so...
Well, John kept sprinkling powdered soap on the floor and asking me to pick it up, so, you know, I just...
I heard you actually had a cold spot when you were sitting down, kind of attach itself to you.
Yeah.
That might
go wherever we need to.
Yeah. I think that might have been that he was sitting on a stainless steel bench and it was 30 degrees.
Yeah.
I knew you were in prison, but I didn't realize. Okay, so it was a steel bench. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay.
So, cool. All right. Anyway. We ended up going to basically all the different locations where the various television teams had picked up information, you know, or other investigators, and we went to the sites, various sites where there's like documented murders and other, you know, horrible things occurred. And I got to tell you, you know, this is a gigantic facility. I mean, the scale is kind of just overwhelming in terms of how big it is. And, you know, I think the place is haunted, but it's not that haunted. You know, I'm going to, like, qualify it because, you know, I usually can go to places and I sense spirits, even if I'm not, like, seeing them or communicating. And to be honest, I only sensed three things that I identified with intelligent spirits, and all three of them were different, so I'm going to give it that there was at least three. But I was really expecting a whole lot more, given... you know, the history and the hype and all that. And one of the things that Tim had mentioned earlier, the place does have residual energy to it. You know, there's just areas that just have this, like, feel to them. And it's not that, like, ooh, we're in the dark and we're in this, like, spooky environment kind of feel. I mean, it literally has something that, you know, it's like, it's almost tangible. You know, you can almost feel it. I mean, literally touch it, if you want. I mean, you're sensing it, but... and there's a number of places throughout the prison where, I mean, that really comes across.
Let me ask you a question. Did you guys actually have anything significant happen that you captured?
No, and we'll talk about why, basically.
Well, that's where I was leading with it. Well, but I mean,
okay.
You know.
But there was actually one event. At one point, Tim and I are, like, struggling to deal with the fact that we were there were a lot of inappropriate live people running around this prison, totally complicating our ability to really, you know, collect any meaningful evidence or anything. But at this one point, I got a very strong sense of this male spirit, and what was interesting was, like, two or three cells away from where I was at, there was this couple. And they were doing something in the cell with a K2 meter, and we didn't know what they were doing in there. We couldn't hear them because they were, like, one of the few people being appropriate and talking very quietly. But I'm talking to Tim saying, you know, there's this spirit. It's, like, over in this general area, and as that was happening, you know, it was probably about a 3 to 5 minute window that I'm sensing this, and Tim and I are like, you know, checking these cells and stuff like that. These people right, literally, you know, two cells over from us, their K2 meter had, they said, now I didn't see it, but they said that it had gone from green. Now, there's no power in these buildings where we were, okay? Went from green and pegged into the red and remained in the red for about 5 minutes.
Yeah, it was going back and forth. That's why they were in the cell, because they were just watching it go off in the cell. And that's what they were doing while we were outside.
And, you know, the other thing was is they at one point they asked us over, and we were checking it out. And I went into the cell, and the K2 meter had stopped going crazy at that point. And I sensed, like, the spirit leaving. And then after that, there was no K2 fluctuations. You know, there was no EMF fluctuations on the K2 meter at all. Doug's asking what prison. We were at Moundsville Prison in Moundsville, West Virginia.
Of the 80-something people that died there, most of them were hung, actually. Only, like, 9 died in the actual electric chair.
Oh, wow.
So, did you get a souvenir, by the way?
I got a T-shirt, yeah. Yeah, I got a T-shirt.
And what was on the T-shirt?
Oh, it's got a nice graphic of electric chair with, like, little electric bolts around it, and it says, Old Sparky.
Yeah. So they have a museum as part of the this complex where they have the old electric chair and some of the equipment that was associated with those executions. They actually have a hangman's noose there, and then they had all kinds of artifacts from when the prison was operating, all the various types of weapons that the guards used over the years. They had all the various kinds of weapons that the inmates created over the years. You know, it was actually a pretty nicely done museum.
Cool.
Now,
well, I got a question. This is just let me ask it and put it this way: if you were to film the individuals that you were noticing investigating around you, would this be like a how or what not to do on an investigation demonstration film? Like a good training film about, you know, kind of like one of these safety films about what not to do on investigations.
Yeah, ghosts aren't deaf. Don't shine your flashlight in somebody else's face. Those kind of things.
Yeah, you know, for those people in the chat room and they're listening, if anyone's seen, you know, the movie Jackass, well, just think of the paranormal version of Jackass the movie. And let me tell you something, you know, all of us have probably gone on to YouTube and looked at some of the incredibly stupid paranormal team video clips that get put up. Well, Tim and I got to see it in real life, and let me tell you, when it's happening to you, it's far less amusing as when you're watching people being stupid on your computer.
Now, I got a question. You said something earlier when I was talking to you before air time about people throwing batteries.
Used batteries, yeah.
What do you mean? I mean, were they playing catch or were they throwing them off?
No, like when their batteries died, instead of like putting them in a trash or whatever, they just dropped them on the floor.
Oh, you're joking. Mm-hmm. And they let these people come into this place?
Well, how about the firecracker, dude?
Yeah.
What? Firecracker?
Somebody lit a big bang, you know. It was like, well, actually, John and I thought it was like a metal table or something dropping, but then he goes, oh, I just stopped at the fireworks store and, you know, it fell out of my pocket.
He had some kind of contact
like those snapping pops. I know what you're talking about.
But not like that, but in the sense
much more powerful.
It's big.
Really loud.
Yeah.
And then somebody else banged table in one point. I was thinking, okay, is this going to keep going on? Like every section we go to, somebody's going to, you know, bang something drop something.
And the answer to that question is yes. As a matter of fact, they are. you know, someone in the chat room's asking, you know, have we investigated there before? No, we actually had gone out here. Tim and I decided to go on a public tour, a public ghost hunt, just because knowing farewell that this was probably going to happen. But we wanted to scope the place out so we could determine whether next season that the Shenandoah Shadows team would actually rent the whole facility for a night to do a real investigation. And so that's why we were there. And, you know, to be honest, you know, we're hoping it was going to be better than it was just in terms of how people were going to behave. But
you're hoping
it didn't really
be
happen.
A little less crowded, but, you know, less people.
So let me – so if you guys could just kind of relate to the level of frustration, it took us 5 hours to drive there, okay? And we only actually attempted to investigate, what, for maybe 2 hours, Tim?
Well, it's about 12:30 midnight. Yeah, after midnight, I think is when we
I mean, the historical tour was fine. I'm glad we did that. That was interesting. But trying to investigate just didn't work. And, you know, we decided rather than stay there that we were just it made more sense for us just to drive back 5 hours instead of staying there until 6 a.m. to investigate, because it was that frustrating. I was having a real hard time just dealing with how stupid people were being. And I guess I was getting so cranked up that I was a source of amusement for Tim, because he just kept kind of smiling and seeming like, well, you know, there is a silver lining to all this. John's head's going to explode any moment here, and maybe I can document it with the camcorder.
Was it like I had a question, Tim. Was it the look like somebody's trying to read a book and there's a kid in the room interrupting them so they can't get a sentence in, or was it like the parent that can't seem to keep the children under wraps and they're getting strung out?
Well, it's kind of hard to see him because everywhere we went, somebody was shining a light in my face. So, yeah.
Well, enough said there.
Yeah.
But I did sense it. I could feel it in waves coming off of him. And finally, I was the one who said, you want to just go? Because I could tell he was getting to the end of his rope.
Now, I'll tell you something, guys. When I was up at the sanatorium, we had some good investigators there. But on the whole, some of them were different and not professional. And the times that I was away from them, I didn't have an issue, and I was, you know, could do what I needed to do. But when they were around, I know what you mean. It's just like the atmosphere changes, and you can't get anything. You know, it's just like being at a party, and it's loud.
Well, you know, part of it's just the acoustics of a prison. You know, a hospital actually has better acoustics in terms of not carrying sound in the same way, even though I'm sure that at that sanatorium, because everything's all stripped down in the way it would be, there'd be sound issues as well. But when you have a prison where it's literally all four stories are exposed, so you have this just like huge, it's like hangars. And you know, it's like the ultimate echo chamber. And, you know, some people, you know, were doing very quiet EVP sessions, and so they could be at the far end or on an upper level, and there'd be no issue to it. But then there were like these people that were like, I guess they thought ghosts were deaf. Or that you had to talk real loud because they're dead, or maybe because I don't know what. But literally, they would be like, you know, 50 to 100 yards away from us, and they would be talking so loud, and it would be echoing in there, that it washed everything out. And then it was like the things that they were saying was just so incredibly, embarrassingly ignorant. You know, they were trying to provoke. This one group of women was trying to provoke this guy that had been murdered. Now, here's someone that's been murdered. And, you know, he was in there because, you know, he was a murderer. But this guy had gotten essentially ice picked in the eye. And so they're trying to provoke the spirit. And I don't know. It just, you know, the whole thing just was, you know, I'm not a provoker type investigator. So I don't like that to begin with. But the whole thing just reeked of, you know, disrespect. And then, like, you know, we were talking about how people were throwing their used batteries around. They were throwing their, you know, Red Bull cans around. People were smoking where, you know, they told people where there were designated areas. Well, people were smoking pretty much wherever they wanted to. And then they would just flick their cigarettes out. They wouldn't even, like, crush them out. So, you know, there's, like, lit cigarettes, you know, laying all here and there and everything like that. Yeah. And it was just crazy, just the level of disrespect.
Hey guys, I've got that's bad. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. We've got a question in the chat room. Kiko is asking, what setting do you use, or excuse me, what setting do you set your tri-field meter on to detect ghosts? Magnetic 1 to 100, magnetic 0 to 3, electric or radio microwave?
What kind of meters are you using?
That's what they're asking. Yeah, what kind of meter are you using, Kiko? It said tri-field.
Is it tri-field natural?
Tri-field meter model 100XC.
Natural? Hang on. The natural?
I'm fine.
Did he say it had electric and a magnetic setting?
Yes.
And a RF setting?
It's electric and radio microwave. Yeah, evidently they do have RF and electric.
I think if it's like one I have, if he sets it to electric, it should be able to do both electric and magnetic readings simultaneously. If you switch it to the magnetic, it's going to ignore the electric. So it basically depends on what you're trying to detect.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the ranges. I mean, do you set it to a high range, like 1 to 100, or like to a low range, 0 to 3?
I use the higher range for myself. The other thing, though, is I have a natural meter, and so if he has a tri-field meter that's not the natural meter, then it's measuring AC, and so we're talking a meter that I don't have and I'm not familiar with the pros and cons in terms of, you know, how to use it.
And I don't think there's any hard, fast rules either, because basically you're just using the meter to measure, you know, fluctuations in the field.
Right, the environment.
And you're trying to eliminate, ones that have natural causes that you can figure out what it's causing it.
Right.
And then all that does is it gives you the possibility of something paranormal, but that's it. It's not like you know you've got a ghost there just because your meter's
right.
going off and you can't
right.
explain why.
Yeah, a lot of people don't understand, you know, that you're actually reading field lines, whether it's natural or man-made. And what you're detecting, actually, when you see the meter move, is a distortion or the actually field lines moving. And
you've eliminated everything that you can as far as what might explain it. Then it's time to try to do something else. You know,
right.
try EVP or, you know, take some photos. Or,
One of the things, I have this one type of EMF meter called an ELF meter. And that one actually does the lower frequency that the question was asking, and I quit using it because it hardly ever picks anything up. So that's kind of the thing that's really moved me into using the higher frequency range, just because
go ahead.
It just seems that it picks up more stuff.
Going on detailed stuff, I mean, what in your opinion is the best, I mean, what have you had the most success with? Let me put it that way.
Well, that's kind of hard to say because, you know, we have the most success when we have multiple different types of things registering an anomalous event. So, you know, just because your K2 meter goes off or your tri-field goes off, that doesn't mean that there's actually an anomalous event occurring. On the other hand, let's say you have your tri-field meter goes off, and then all of a sudden there's a light anomaly, and then you get something on audio. You know, it's like, for me, that's when it's time to take notice, when you have these multiple unexplained things all occurring within the same event time period.
Okay.
Like a temperature fluctuation.
And see, that's what gets me excited. Any one of these things just singly and on their own, yeah, it's interesting, but, you know, how much weight does it actually carry and what does it mean? But when you couple all these things together collectively, then you have to ask yourself, well, what's the chances that all that just randomly just happened, you know?
Right, it's simultaneously, right.
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 As far as, you know, meters, you know, I have a Tri-Field natural meter. I like that a lot. My favorite meter right now is a Mel meter because it has the built-in thermal coupling probe on it, so I can get real-time EMF field readings as well as the ambient temperature, which is really good because, you know, everyone that's shooting, you know, the infrared gun-style temperature readings, you know, they're actually reading whatever wall that beam's hitting on or whatever surface versus the actual air temperature. So, you know, when you have the Mel meter next to you and you feel like the temperature's dropping, you're actually getting a more accurate reading than, you know, any other type of way of measuring the temperature. So I really like that particular meter. Plus, the backlight's so bright that you don't actually need to be using a flashlight. Now, the downside is it eats 9-volt batteries like all get out, so you better have
a pocket. They make them with the red lights too now, so you can get them with red light, so it's a little less blinding.
Wow, so it's an energy hog. Does it actually have a data logger built into it so you can actually take snapshots of stuff happening? You know what I mean, as far as the readings are concerned?
Yeah, you can have it set for high and low, and I think it'll record. I have never tried using that function, but I know it's there. You can use it if you want to as a data logger type thing.
Cool. So, hey Tim, now that you know we got you on the radio for the first time, what was it that got you into the paranormal field? Did you have like a particular life experience or experiences that just kind of like, you know,
well,
got
probably,
you where you're at now?
I think you've heard that so many times now, it sounds cliche, but it's just, you know, typical of people in this field have had experiences when they were younger. Most of my experiences were in my youth. As I got older, of course, I stopped having experiences. And I've only been doing this now for a couple of years, but it seems like as I've been doing it, I've been having more experiences. So, of course, it helps when you're going to places like Jordan Springs and Waverly and, you know, places that are active. But
Since you just mentioned Jordan Springs and Waverly, is there, in terms of Waverly, did anything at that place particularly pop out and really
besides the bats?
Yeah. Yeah, there were a lot of bats there. There was no doubt about that.
Funny thing, we didn't know they were there until we reviewed the footage and saw them flying all around us. But, well, that's the first place I saw a silhouette of a person. It looked like going down the hall, and I knew it wasn't you two because you two, Joel, and you were near me when it happened. And so that was pretty unique experience.
Wow. Now I got a question. Was Joel the one that got touched by the little girl when you guys were up at Waverly, or was that you, Tim?
No, it was Joel, and John actually, I think, caught a glimpse of her.
Yeah, did you actually see her from the other end of the hall, looking back?
No, I saw her from like about 5 feet from where she was standing, touching Joel at the time. I mean, literally, I could almost have reached out and touched her.
But what,
John's? John saw someone following me, I think, down the hall, but I didn't see him.
Yeah. You see, the thing when you take Tim out on these investigations, he seems to attract wayward women spirits, and Tim's walking down the hall by himself, and Joel and I are watching, and you know, Waverly's so huge that Tim walks so far down the hall, the darkness, you know, essentially engulfed him, so all we could hear is Tim walking. Then we hear him stop. And then we hear him walking back. And then all of a sudden we're hearing Tim's footsteps and a second set of footsteps. And when Tim comes out of the darkness, we continue to hear another set of footsteps. And then we saw this woman's figure literally a few feet behind him. So, yeah. He always seems to get the ladies.
Of course, I didn't see it. So.
Well, you're a magnet. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Irresistible.
Well, we got another question in the chat room. MGH is asking, did you notice or do you do any investigations during Halloween, or do you hide because the activity can be too much? The adjoining question to this is, do you notice that the veils between the worlds lessen, as people say?
You know, I mean, Halloween is a trying time for us because all these people come out. I don't know whether it's because there's all, you know, the stuff on television and all the articles that are in the newspaper and stuff like that, but it seems like everyone wants us at that time point to come out and do an investigation because we have a haunted location. And the fact that it's been haunted for 20 years and they've been dealing with it for 20 years, you know, seems to like, but they need it done right now kind of thing, you know.
And the newspaper interviews too, don't forget.
Yeah, and the newspaper interviews. But in terms of, you know, do I think that things get more active around Halloween? You know, not that I can tell, you know.
I don't think it even matters what time of day or, you know, anything like that. That's, you know, that doesn't seem to be significant in nature. Time doesn't seem to matter, does it?
You know, experiences at all times of the year.
Well, you know, like when the last Jordan Springs event, you know, Sharon had joined us with that, and I had taken her up to the attic, and it was mid-afternoon, probably between 3 and 4, maybe. And so it was totally light. You know, there's like dormer windows and windows on the end of the attic, so it's got all kinds of natural light. I mean, she saw a spirit child in there, you know, in daylight. So I don't think that time and place really is all that important, unless, of course, what we're seeing is a residual entity that's replaying a time and date-specific event. Then that's another story. You know what I'm saying? Like, if there's, like, an anniversary date or, you know, again, a specific time, then I could see that that would be important. But in big picture, I don't really think that it matters, you know? You know, there's certain advantages to doing stuff at night because certain equipment can be used that you can't use in the daytime and vice versa. But personally, I've actually seen more spirits in the daytime than I have at the nighttime. So, I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, hey, Tim, you've been at Jordan Springs, which is an incredibly active place in the daytime and the nighttime. Do you think there's a difference?
I don't know. I think there's some argument that can be made since paranormal activity seems to be, you know, related to electromagnetic fields, that the magnetosphere could have an effect. And, of course, when you have the dark side of the earth and you have that lifting of that pressure, you know, the reason why radio waves go farther, you know, at night might also have an effect whereby more subtle fluctuations might be easier to pick up. So that might explain why a lot of people have experiences, you know, at night. But I know that it can happen just as well in the daytime, you know. And Jordan Springs is a good example of EVPs I've got there in the daytime, you know, as well as at night. So
what's your favorite EVP that you've collected at Jordan Springs?
That'd be kind of tough. It's a toss-up between a few of them. I really like the I'm Stuck Here EVP. And
Can you share with people the context of that?
Well, we're down in the pub, you mean? We're all down there in the pub doing an EVP session, and it's at night. And one of the investigators asks, do you like it in here, or are you stuck here? And there's a slight pause, and then you hear, I'm stuck here. And my recorder picked it up, his recorder picked it up, somebody's video camera picked it up. Like three or four different pieces of equipment picked up this EVP. So that was pretty impressive.
Yeah, so that was an example of an intelligent response, because, I mean, that was, you know, directly connected to the question being asked and almost an immediate response to the question.
Hmm. Right, and very clear.
We have another question. Do you use sensitives on any of your investigations or any spiritual advisors?
Well, John.
That would be me and Joel. Actually, you know, a number of people on our team.
I'm the only one that's not
sensitive. Yeah. Well, Tim says that, but that's not entirely true either.
He's in the closet psychic.
Yeah, there you go.
Don't out me tonight.
So, but yeah, I mean, we also work a lot with a Native American shaman who is a psychic medium, as well as, you know, I would say a spiritual advisor, and he's absolutely incredible to work with. I think that Sharon might attest to that as well. Tim, you were talking about another EVP that you had there that you liked.
Well, I like, hello.
Oh, explain that. What do you mean, hello?
Yeah.
Well,
you got to have context here, man, because it's like, okay, you got to know. Was it a female?
Yeah, I was up in the, well, it sounded like a female. I was up in the attic at Jordan Springs, and I was by myself. I mean, there was other people at the other end, but I went down to the other far end by myself and was walking down there with my recorder. And I walked into something that just felt very electrically charged. And so I just started asking questions. And the question right before the EVP is, I say, I can tell you here. I said, can you say hello to me? And, of course, I didn't hear anything. And then I, you know, walked back down. And when I reviewed the audio, there's a female voice saying hello to me. Very kind of sing-songy.
Kind of like, for those of you that watch old movies, and it's like, imagine Mae West saying, hey, big boy, come up and visit me sometime. It was that kind of a hello. You know, it was the kind of hello that, you know, like
nice
maybe
hello.
If, for instance, the back history of Jordan Springs included it being a brothel.
Yeah, I was going to say.
It was that kind of hello.
Well, that's not the only time this has happened to him, is it?
Well, as a matter of fact, no, it's not the only time that he's picked up stray ladies
Do they know he's been in the Navy before?
Well, you know, I personally,
A sailor's a sailor, man.
but Kirstie's a particular reputation, I guess.
Yeah.
They know you're
a sailor. We like to tease Tim, but, you know, one of the things, it has been, there's been two occasions where I think it was probably a, you know, woman of the night spirit, but
I was oblivious to the one you're talking about. I had no idea the one you're talking about in Fredericksburg. The other one.
We were down in Fredericksburg, and the spirit approached, and like you could get the scent of
the lilac.
The lilac, and you know, what was that? January or February, we were walking down there, so it's like there's no way there was like lilac or lavender out in anywhere. And then it turned out that we were actually, as this guide is explaining where we are, because we were on this historic walk, she says that across the street was this brothel. And it was just like, oh, there you go. But anyway, so Tim gets a lot of grief over that, but I think it's just because they see Tim as the sensitive type, and they're attracted to the quiet, sensitive type man.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, you know what I find fascinating is, and I don't know about everybody else, but I've been on a pretty good investigation myself, and it's just the fact that they're willing to interact. You know, I think, you know, they really don't have a reason to, you know, interact, but they choose to, and I just find that really fascinating. You know,
Well,
I would suggest people that are doing EVP work sometimes, at least for a change up, try to imagine that they are there and just talk to them as if they're there. Don't like say, are you there? You know, or is there anybody here? Just say, hello, how are you? You know, or in other words, don't give them an option to talk to you. Just talk to them and see if they'll respond to you.
Well, you know, I mean, that's a really good point. Right now, I'm reviewing evidence that we collected at Jordan Springs, and I'm reviewing some recordings that Sharon made. And Sharon has an excellent demeanor in terms of how she conducts an EVP session. First of all, her voice is very well modulated, so it's not one of these kind of things where she's getting excited and raises the volume and drops the volume. Because when you're doing review, you know, it blows your ears apart when people start talking loud when it's been they were, you know, talking softly before kind of thing. So it makes the review a whole lot easier. But also, how she talks to the spirits, it's like she's not asking a bunch of one-sided it's not like a one-sided conversation in terms of like she's interrogating. She's having it's more like a conversation, like there's someone sitting, well, there is, but literally like there's someone sitting across the table from her, and she's talking to him. And I'm still doing review on her stuff, but we've got one really good EVP where this female who we had identified months ago as a nurse or a person who nursed the soldiers back to health when there was a hospital there during the Civil War, said essentially that, you know, she was there to, I don't remember what the quote was now, that's what we're going to cure, because Sharon was asking questions in terms of, you know, sort of like what was her purpose, why were you here kind of thing, and what were you doing, and that was the response that they were trying to cure. So, very good, and I'm really looking forward to seeing the recordings that Sharon did when she was up in the attic with the children that are up there. I'm going to be absolutely shocked if we didn't get something pretty compelling there.
Well, now, listen, Mike, go ahead.
We're like running out of time, and we ought to mention what's coming up on Paranexus Universe.
Yeah, we got. Looks like we have David Roundtree joining us again. And David Roundtree is one of the Paranexus consultants. He's returning to discuss his book, Paranormal Technology. And that ought to be a really interesting show. Doug and Grant will be there interviewing him. And I believe you're going to be working the switchboard. And who do we have on taps for next Sunday?
Okay, next Sunday we have a return guest, Robert Graves. He wrote the book, Art of Psychic Dice. And for those of you that want more information about developing your own PK abilities, he's the man to listen to. He explains PK in a way that's kind of a lot easier to grasp than others, and he's got some interesting insights as well. And that's next Sunday night, which would be November 14th at 10 p.m. Eastern Time.
And Paranexus Universe will be at what time?
9 p.m.
Right?
Eastern. Yeah.
Right. 9 o'clock p.m. So, yeah, and that ought to be a good show. I always like listening to David Roundtree. He's very professional about, you know, the things he works with. And I guess everybody have a great week, and we'll see you Thursday night with Doug and Grant, and John and I will be back Sunday night. So everybody have a great week. What?
Thanks, everyone, for listening in. And hey, Tim, thank you for joining us tonight. We enjoyed talking with you.
I enjoyed it.
And, Tim, just hang on the line. And, okay. Everyone, you have a good night. Goodbye.